Chapter 15. Recruiters. I felt as if the entire mob had trampled me on the previous day. My joints ached, my head ached, and my guts turned inside of me like a sour froth. Something warm and soft knocked against my temple. It had bristles that poked my skin like soft needles, and when I unstuck my eyes, I learned it was Ambrosius. He'd risen before me and was nosing through the straw looking for shoots that were still green. I reposed over the thickest part of it, and he was trying to nudge me out of the way. I accepted the abuse a while without comment, hoping he would finally give up, but he didn't. His velvet lips clapped together over my nose, just grazing the tip, and every time he knocked my head around with his muzzle, it made my brains ache. When I had enough, I fended him off with one arm while I lurched to my feet, climbing the fence of his pen like a ladder. It was early morning. The sky was bright, and a low mist clung to the ground, sliding along the surface like a meeting of spirits. I knew that mist well. It was the mist that came slowly in the earliest hours of the morning when the cart was laden down with all my tools and hitched up to Ambrosius and us walking together along the old trail to the mountain. Sunna comes on slow in the morning. You feel him before you see him. You sense the quality of the air change around you so that it feels like wakefulness more than light. As you walk, you find that all the things you'd thought were black were really just blue. And then a little while later, you learn that the blue is also a lie. It's really green and brown. And there are yellows and oranges and purples everywhere. Everywhere in the flowers and the leaves and the trees. The whole world comes alive with colors you never would have expected. Colors you only recently forgot about. You forget it all when the night comes, when the world goes dark. The colors you thought you knew fade away, and you remember again that you live only in an ink-stained place. But in the day you are reminded. The color of Erda returns, and you wonder how you ever forgot her beauty. And then you turn south to see his throne suspended in mid-air between the belly and the spine, moored within the vast Mittlera Sea. And the throne burns with a yellow-white fire that hurts your eyes, and the whole world around you is warmth and newness. Sometimes I think the feelings Sunna brings us in the morning are the only reasons I limit my drinking to the end of the day. Meeting Sunna in the morning without my wits always felt like blasphemy. I didn't have any fresh straw to lay down for Ambrosius, and his oat barrel was empty. So I led him into the Yarnsberg forest, which drew my shack into its bosom like a friendly arm. We found a patch of bitterwort at the base of a gnarled old oak tree. I tied Ambrosius's lead to a low branch and gave him a quick scratch behind the ears, letting him know I'd be back soon to water him. A few moments later, he erupted with a stream of urine so powerful it dug furrows through the soil, where it steamed and mixed in with the morning's mist. I decided it was a good thing and joined him. As my own pitiful jet mingled with the donkey's river, I found my purse and dipped two fingers into its mouth and counted out my marks by touch. I went through them twice before I was satisfied that all five were there. I was thinking about those marks. Very carefully, I was thinking about them. I was thinking of ways to make them multiply. Five marks was a handsome sum. Something I would have earned only after digging a good long time. Especially now, considering the sudden unexpected lowering of my prices. Long periods of backbreaking labor, the kind of labor that got one ostracized from his peers. And then, on the other hand, here was 5 marks in my purse, earned without effort at the swipe of a giant, and afterward we had eaten and drunk all night for free. The problem with the Craft Creek is that it's annual. They don't hold these contests all year round. The years are divided up into periods separate from the months we have applied to collections of weeks, and each of these periods is dedicated to a god. There is a period of early growth that signals the beginning of a new year, the time when the flowers bloom and the animals give birth to their young, when the new crops are laid into the soil. This is the time when new buildings are begun. It is the time that the New Year festival is held. This is the season of Ing. Following her time comes a period of growth, of combat and struggle. This is when you must tend your crops, when you must fight against Erda's rhythms for the sake of your harvest, when you must strive to save as much of the harvest as you can, because Erda never will give it all to you. She'll take a portion of the harvest for herself. We live within her, after all, and the Verm must eat. But we eat as well, and so must battle her to protect the harvest, to protect the herd, to preserve and propagate our livestock. This is the season of Tyr, the war god. It is the season when the Kraftkrieg is held. I knew I couldn't limit our income to the Kraftkrieg only. The contests came only once a year, and we must live well through all seasons, not just one. But I thought our success from the previous day showed the path. I believed it showed the way ahead, showed the pattern to follow. Yesterday had shown me a future in which I need not dig, in which I need not be hated, or beaten, or shunned. It had shown me a life of relative ease, in which I need not bend to the spade day in and day out for handfuls of bits. I had seen the path that ended in a bucket of fresh stamped marks. I left Ambrosius in the forest to take his ease, wandered back to my shack, and poked my head in to find the giant sitting quietly on the bed. "Risa, are you well?"
"Drink," he boomed.
"Oh, I see you learned some new words last night."
"Champion."
"Yes, yes, that is also a new word."
"Three-legged beauty."
"All right, that'll do." He stood into a bent position to avoid punching his head through the thatching. Smacking his lips happily, he went to the door, scratching one enormous half of his rump. The door clapped shut, and then I could see him walking past my walls outside as the sunlight that spilled through the cracks between the boards was blocked and then came through again a moment later. I could hear him moving around out there like an old bear. My shack creaked on one side, and I realized he was leaning up against a wall. Shortly after, I heard the hot splatter of the giant's relief. It sounded every bit as forceful as what the donkey had unleashed earlier that morning. I went outside to find him tucking himself back into the loincloth.
"We simply must do something about your clothing," I said. "I can't have you going around like this." I looked down at my own rags then and said,
"Probably we should do something for the both of us. It'll be important for us to be presentable going forward. Well, me more than you, probably."
"Huh.
Maybe I should just wrap you up in animal furs. We could play up a wild man angle." He just looked at me curiously, as if the things I said were deep secrets beyond his understanding. I reached up and patted his elbow.
"Don't worry, Risa. We'll get you figured out soon enough. But in the meantime, we'd better get back to town, eh? I think the foot races should be starting soon. Maybe today or tomorrow. I've seen you move, and I have no doubt you can take the contest. I just have to figure out how to get the bets going again. I don't know if I can convince anyone to bet against you after what happened yesterday." I trailed off as I stood there thinking about it. How indeed. Risa tapped me on the shoulder, and I shrugged when I looked at him.
"Okay, okay," I said. "One thing at a time. Come on. Let's you and I head into town, young man, and see what kind of trouble we can get into." As it happened, the kind of trouble we could get into was severe. When we rounded the last bend into the village square, I saw many things at once. I saw many of the tables still left out from the night before. There were some scraps still on platters, all of which boasted a nice cloud of flies. The things we'd overturned and ruined in our drunken state had not yet been corrected, but this was not what caught my eye. These were details I happened to notice as I took in the detachment of armed soldiers who stood in a line at the center of the village square, 10 wide and 2 deep, and the 4 very official-looking men before the soldiers who sat atop some very serious-looking horses. These weren't the slow-moving, heavy-shouldered plow horses we like to keep up north, either. These animals were sleek and willowy, like the limbs of a fine bough, with deep chests and powerful muscles, thick veins running up and down their limbs like the tracery of many rivers.
They stood stock still, their swishing tails the only signs of movement. My eyes darted from them to the villagers collected into a mob in the dirt square. I recognized most of them, but thought I saw some of the visitors with whom I'd celebrated on the previous night as though they'd been lumped in with our people. "God damn it, get down," I hissed. I grabbed Reese's arm and pulled him off the trail. We plunged between a couple of homes and hid under cover, Reese staring at me in confusion while I panted. He began to prod at me, and I waved him off. Then I grabbed his hand and put it on my shoulder to let him know it was all right. I listened for any signs of pursuit, a shout, or maybe the blast of a horn, approaching hoofbeats, the rattle of mail. There was nothing. "I don't think they saw us," I whispered. "Listen, I want you to keep your hand wrapped up in my shirt, okay? Keep that hand right there. Have you got it?" I hope you do anyway. And be quiet. Be as quiet as you can." I put a finger up to my lips and shushed for him. He did the same back to me, and I had no fucking idea if that meant he understood, but it was about the best I could get. "Come on then," I whispered, and led him beyond the old wooden buildings into the forest. He seemed to take a cue from the way I moved. I could feel that he was crouched low behind me. He would have had to crouch just to keep in contact with my shoulder, and he made very little noise with his bare feet, no matter how large they were. We were still a good distance away from the square, but I continued to whisper to him as we made our way closer. "One of two things are happening the way I see it. I recognize the colors those soldiers wore. They belong to the Lord Ambrosius. I thought I saw the device of a few of the lesser horses on their shields, the men on horseback. But the colors were all Ambrosius. It means they're up here either to arrest an outlaw or collect more conscriptions for Dithmar's fucking war. And if I know my ass from a hole in the ground, it'll be conscriptions. They don't send a force like that for a simple arrest. You just get a visit from the closest sheriff. We'd better be certain, though. Quietly, Risa. Be as quiet as a sleeping babe." We crept along the rear of Herdin's alehouse, then crawled up to the front on our hands and knees. There was a huge pile of cordwood along the south wall for the kitchen, stacked up high enough that Risa could huddle behind it out of sight. As we crawled forward on our hands and knees, the words of one of the soldiers began to resolve. I soon learned the man speaking was a captain.
"Able-bodied men, aged 13 to 50, shall present themselves before me for selection now. Those selected shall travel with us back to Colmar for training, where you'll be molded into soldiers. You shall be armed and outfitted."
"Begging your pardon, Captain."
"Remove your hand from my mount, sir."
"Apologies. My apologies, Captain. I meant nothing by it, please."
"That sounds like Herdin," I whispered. "Poor bastard sounds fit to shit himself."
"I will let it pass this one time, old man. Do not make the same presumption again."
"No, good Captain, of course. Please forgive me."
"We shall see. Speak now."
"Thank you, Captain. Please, sir, the ages. 13 to 50?
"Yes."
"Well, Captain, it's just that we survive on the harvest this far north. We need men with strong backs to work the fields, you see, sir."
"Oh, please. You high north types are as hardy as oxen."
"You flatter us, sir, and bless you for it. But I must insist. It's hard living here at the edge. And our elders are indeed strong. There's no denying."
"How old are you, sir?"
the captain interrupted.
"My age?
Do not force me to repeat myself."
"Of course, I apologize. 52, my captain."
"Well, then what are you bothering me about? You needn't worry."
I'm the mayor, good captain, and I must concern myself with the health of this village. And strong though our elders may be, they are not numerous enough to work this land."
"Then have your women work alongside them. They appear capable. They certainly appear to be as ugly as the men in this part of the world."
They are indeed strong, noble captain, and yet they must keep their hearth.
they haven't the time to work the fields because...
Yes, yes, and now you bore me. Look, each man pressed into the service of the crown is paid a wage, a damned fine wage. I dare say you'll be paid a wage far better than you'd earn toiling away in this bitter wasteland. A half mark a day, paid to every man regardless of his duties, with a real possibility of advancement. If you do well, if your superiors approve of you, you may be promoted to higher ranks. With an increase in rank comes an increase in pay. Think about that. And if any of you so choose, you may ask your commander to send a portion or all of your wages home to your loved ones. The crown promises to see your pay delivered safely under armed escort as needed to confound any bandits.
It is most generous, incredibly generous, Herdin said.
I hated him as he spoke. Hated the way he spoke to that pompous fucking captain. He was the mayor of our town, the man we'd elected. Well, the man they had elected, Diggers never got a say. To speak for us. To speak with our voice. And there he was, bending like a reed under that captain's scrutiny, his back curving over fit to snap while he constantly dry-washed his hands like a beggar. It made me sick to my stomach. It was disgraceful. Keep your head down, I hissed over my shoulder. Don't let anyone see us, no matter what you do. Herdin continued. The wages are assuredly better than any of us deserve, being hopelessly unskilled farmers, sir, who know the plow like the backs of our hands but look on the sword like a confounding piece of foreign artistry. You'll be given spears, for the most part, the captain interrupted.
Indeed. And even these are likely beyond our simple minds. But what I meant to say, honored sir, was that our wages, generous though they may be, will not fill the bellies here while the men are gone. Without the bodies necessary to work our fields, the money becomes meaningless. We will starve, sir. And I have frankly grown weary of arguing this with you, the captain sighed. I will have the men I came for now. Step forward.
13-year-olds are not men,
a woman shouted. I winced and hung my head.
Who said that? The captain shouted. Who was it that spoke? Step forward now.
I watched in horror as Stavka's wife, Marguerite, presented herself to the captain. She looked very small standing alone in the middle of the dirt like that, but her back was straight as an iron bar, unlike Herdin's. She was either very brave or very foolish. I suspect she was brave. She had seen conscriptions before. We had none of us ever seen a conscription spanning such a wide range of ages, but the people of that village had dealt with soldiers before. She damned well knew what was coming, and she came forward with a straight back. She was quite a woman, braver by far than her gutless husband, Stavka. The captain looked down his nose at her and asked,
What is your name?
Marguerite, wife of Stavka.
And do you have a son, Marguerite?
I do, sir.
How old is this son?
He's 13, sir.
She never looked away from him, bless her.
I see. And where is your husband? Where is Stavka?
Stavka stepped forward and said,
Here I am, sir.
The captain scoffed. Your wife speaks to me like a man, and yet you cower within the crowd. I've half a mind to take her with me and leave you here. The captain looked to the mounted soldier on his left, nodded, and gestured to Marguerite with a flap of his gloved hand. The soldier dismounted and approached her.
What is this? Stavka demanded. What are you? Get away from her!
The soldier who had dismounted took Marguerite by the arm and led her to the cold fire pit in the center of the square while Stavka rushed after. More soldiers, those of the footbound infantry, leaped forward and took him into custody. They pulled Stavka's arms out to either side, forced him down to his knees, and pulled his head up by the hair to watch. The soldier who took Marguerite to the fire pit now turned her to face the rest of the villagers. And when we saw her face, We understood she appeared brave only because to have appeared any other way would have betrayed the terror in her heart. The soldier put his hands up behind her neck and yanked. I heard the sound of ripping fabric, and then her breasts were suddenly exposed to the morning air. They hung low with large, darkened nipples. They were mother's breasts. There was something beyond the breasts of a woman you simply wanted to fuck. They had been used to grow her child. They had been a part of bringing her boy into the world, of raising him and keeping him alive. They were sacred objects now, sanctified in the way she had used them for her child, sanctified in the way her child had used them, in the way he had transformed them. And now they were being profaned in the morning air. Secret, wonderful aspects of her now hung out in the open like an insult. They were a source of wonder now rendered shameful, and she crossed her arms over them in her shame. And I wept to see it. I wept to see her shamed for a part of herself that held such deep mystery. The soldier produced a leather strap and ripped it down the skin of her back. I heard Stavka scream. He screamed so loud that Marguerite's scream was lost. But we still saw her legs buckle, still saw her drop to her knees in the dirt and bend double and raise her arms to protect her head and neck. The soldier continued to whip her, laying three more stripes along her back and two across each side of her ass. When he was done, he jerked her back to her feet, put a boot into her ass, and kicked her forward. She stumbled, nearly fell, as she struggled to pull the ruined top of her dress over her breasts. The man who restrained Stavka released his arms. The one on the left kicked him between the shoulders, pitching him down into the dirt. Marguerite was upon him soon after, lifting him gently and trying her very best to soothe him between racking sobs.
"Able-bodied men between 13 and 50, step forward now," the captain commanded.
There was another shout, this time from the rear of the gathering. I recognized it at once, nearly ran out from behind my cover when I heard it. The only thing that kept me from doing so was Reese's hand bound up in my shirt. I almost fell over when he drew me up short. It was Nix. He was shouting something. I couldn't tell what he said. It was just incoherent noise, frantic noise, as he broke from the crowd and ran. Some of the others called after him. They begged him to stop and come back. Most of them just looked away. Hardin looked away. Stavka and Marguerite didn't seem to notice. They just huddled in the dirt holding on to each other, both of them crying. One of the men on horseback, not the captain, broke off and rode after Nix. He rode Nix down. Just fucking trampled him under the horse's hooves. Nick hit the ground, twitching along his limbs, and I could see he'd been knocked senseless. Even so, the soldier on the horse rounded, rode back slowly, taking his time. And when he approached Nix, he lowered his lance, pressed the tip into the fallen man's back, and thrust until it punched through to the dirt. We all heard him cough and sputter for a while, for a long goddamned while, before he ceased making any more sounds at all. The soldier returned to his captain's side.
"I really do hope this will be the end of the morning's excitement," the captain said.
He sounded bored. "Come on," I whispered to Risa. "Let's get the fuck out of here."